Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 23rd of October. How did Vice President Dick Cheney become Vice President Dick Cheney? That's just one of the questions we'll have answered during the course of this hour with the author of Angler, The Cheney Vice Presidency. Barton Gellman is our guest. Barton is a special projects reporter at the Washington Post who has covered diplomacy, the Middle East, the Pentagon, and the D.C. Superior Court. He's winner of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for a series of articles on Vice President Cheney's domestic agenda. He also won one in 2002. He's the author of Contending with Kennan, Toward a Philosophy of American Power. And it's a fascinating look, not only the first part of the book, it looks at, you know, he was in charge of vetting vice presidential candidates and coming up with them, and then he got the job, how that happened. But it also looks at a number of other issues. Cheney's style, it looks at the National Security Administration issues. It looks at Iraq and how he fashioned the vice presidency and more. So we welcome phone calls for Barton. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that's okay. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Barton, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Yeah. I was reading about all this work some of these fellows went to thinking they maybe had a shot at becoming vice president. Tons and tons of papers. They're spending their vacation digging up everything, and it really didn't make much difference, huh?
Sure didn't. You think of Lamar Alexander, his story I tell, who had come off the enormously disappointing result running for the GOP nomination himself, and he's just about to start 4 weeks of biking and hiking and beaching up in Nantucket, and Cheney persuades him to put his name in, and so suddenly he's spending his whole vacation collecting boxes of paperwork and talking to lawyers and accountants and so on. The thing about it, as I tell it in the story in Chapter 1, is that Cheney says, "I'll call you at the end of the month and we'll schedule an appointment," and the call never comes.
Right. To say nothing of what happens to Frank Keating.
Well, Frank Keating was governor of Oklahoma, as a lot of your listeners will recall. He was a very popular Republican there. He was considered a short-lived candidate to be George Bush's running mate. They were actually old friends. And Keating not only didn't get the job, but a chunk of his vetting file, and Cheney had devised just about the most intrusive sort of scrutiny ever devised for a vice presidential nominee. Chunk of Keating's vetting file, and a distorted chunk of it at that, gets leaked to Newsweek, which essentially destroys him politically.
Yeah, it sure does destroy him. And can you tell that story? Because it's a fascinating one. Because he struggles with this moral issue and decides to come clean on it, and it does him in.
Yeah, well, the story is that Frank Keating, he had, you know, one of those golden political resumes. He'd been an FBI special agent. He'd been a U.S. attorney. He'd been number two and number three Justice Department official and other kinds of big Washington, D.C. jobs. Now he's coming back and he's governor of Oklahoma. He's befriended by a guy who he's one of these zealots for a cause. The guy has come to believe that this one medicine that helped him through a bout of depression is sort of a miracle drug that helps with all sorts of things, and Keating sort of listens sympathetically but doesn't sort of do anything for him in terms of government policy. But the guy comes to really like Keating and says, "Look, I'm a rich man. I'd like to pay for your kids' college education."
Cool.
Which, you know, it's kind of a nice little gift for anybody, $250,000 or thereabouts. And Keating checks with the federal ethics offices and gets an okay on this in terms of the law and the ethical requirements. Now, yeah, and someone might say it's a little bit naive of a guy who runs as Mr. Clean to take that kind of a gift, whether or not there seem to be strings attached, but he took it. What happened is that when it was leaked to Newsweek, the leaker told Newsweek's investigative reporter, Michael Isikoff, that Keating had a skeleton in his closet and that he had not disclosed these gifts. And that was false. And because of that, and because it took some time for the truth to catch up to the leak, it became a giant issue in Oklahoma, and it just demolished his career there.
Mm-hmm. And the only person who would have known this would have been Cheney or somebody who was looking at the vetting papers, right? It wasn't widely spread around.
Dick Cheney made an arrangement with George Bush when he was asked to do the vetting. He said, I'm going to keep this extremely close hold. The fewer the eyes, the fewer the leaks, and the fewer the sort of egos to stroke in this whole process. And so the only ones who saw it, besides Dick Cheney, were his were pretty much three closest people: his older daughter Liz, a guy who'd been working for him for many years and knew him since high school, and the man who became the vice president's counsel in the White House, David Addington.
Mm-hmm.
There were some smaller tasks parceled out to a law firm, and that was under the supervision of Cheney's son-in-law. Now, that's the whole group. Even Karl Rove, Dan Bartlett, the top people in the Bush campaign, were not allowed access to these things. And so Frank Keating, who's been sitting on this anger all these years and never talked about it before, gave me an extensive interview, set of interviews for the book, and he actually, I persuaded him to send me the entire vetting file. I mean, I don't know, 800, 900 pages that he'd submitted. It included every page of his medical records, every dime he ever earned, his entire assets, even had all his Social Security numbers intact, which, of course, I wouldn't publish. But in any case, he, in order to demonstrate that he had disclosed this thing, he showed me everything he disclosed.
Mm-hmm.
And he speaks in quite angry terms and using words that you can't say on radio to describe his reaction to Dick Cheney leaking this. That's his accusation. And what was as remarkable to me as a Republican governor, an old friend of Bush, accusing Cheney of this on the record, is that another Republican governor, old friend of Bush, John Engler of Michigan, who was also said to be a finalist for the job, told me he believes that Frank Keating is right, that it could only have come from Cheney.
Hmm. And Cheney didn't do the same kind of vetting for Cheney, did he?
Well, it's funny because at the time, Karen Hughes, who was then spokeswoman for the campaign, assured reporters when Cheney was chosen that he had subjected himself to the same vetting as everyone else. And that was her term, and of course it raised some interesting, epistemological questions about how you subject yourself to vetting. But what turns out to be true, and we haven't known this until now, is that Cheney did not fill out his own questionnaire. He did not answer the 200-plus questions that he made everyone else answer. He did not produce his FBI files and his tax returns and his full medical records. In fact, the campaign brought out an eminent heart surgeon in Houston to vouch for the health of Cheney's heart. And in the book, he is interviewed, and he says on the record that he never met Cheney or reviewed even one page of Cheney's medical records.
How did that happen?
Well, the campaign portrayed it one way. What actually happened is that Cheney's own doctor vouched to George Bush that Cheney was healthy. George Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, first President Bush, recommended that his son get a second opinion. So they call this guy Denton Cooley, famous heart surgeon in Houston. But all that Cooley does is he calls Cheney's doctor, has a relatively brief phone conversation with him, which the same doctor makes the same assurance to Cooley. I think his heart is healthy enough to be vice president. And Cooley comes out and says that.
Mm-hmm.
So he found the man open and persuasive on the phone, but he did not review the records for himself, which is certainly what the campaign was portraying at the time.
So when do you think Cheney decided that he wanted to be vice president? Was it very early on?
You know, this is one of those, the inside of Cheney's head remains a black box, no matter how many hundreds of people interview for the book, and I can't tell you that, and I try very carefully in the book, you know, 70 pages of endnotes to say how I purport to know things that I write in this book, and I'm pretty transparent about it. So in this case, I have to say, first of all, that I don't know. I do spend a lot of time trying to unpack that in the book, and I can demonstrate when he takes certain steps that continue to leave the job open to him. And one of the things that Cheney has been very good at over the years is positioning himself so that he has maximum visibility, that he can see as clearly as possible. He has the sort of best spot to know when a decision will be made so that he can decide how he wants to play it. Now, if you are running the process, you get a pretty good idea when George Bush is starting to make up his mind. One of the pieces of evidence that he did want at least to hold that option open from an early time is that the objections he raised against himself, because he played hard to get, the objections he raised were all either curable or not really objections, or the kind of thing that was not up to him but up to Bush. So he said, you know, well, you have to realize I've got this heart history. But when Bush asks him, do you think that you are capable of doing the job? Do you think that your health would prevent you from doing the job? He says, no, I was Secretary of Defense during the Gulf War, which is an awfully stressful time. I've been running a large corporation. I travel. So the problem is not whether my heart is healthy enough to do the job. The problem is that it would subject you to political attack to choose me because my heart might seem to be not healthy. And that places this right in Bush's
head. Right.
He's not saying it's a problem for me. He's saying it's a problem for you, and that's up to Bush to decide.
Yeah, interesting. I was thinking as I was reading that part of the book, what if he had been in charge of looking at vice presidential vetting for John McCain? I doubt that they would come up with the person they did, right? It would have been a little bit more thorough, except when it came to him, if he wanted to do the job again.
Well, I have to say that Sarah Palin is being very, very thoroughly vetted. It's just it's happening in real time in our eyes by the news media.
Yeah.
And it's not that McCain's people don't know how to vet a candidate. In fact, he had the same lawyer who advised Lamar Alexander through the vetting process for George Bush in 2000, a guy named A.B. Kolbehouse, was in charge of the vetting process for McCain. And again, this is a place I don't know as a fact, but knowing everything I know about Kolbehouse and his history, I strongly doubt that he told McCain, well, we've gone through thoroughly and found nothing on Palin. I mean, I'm sure that the advice he would have given is, this is, of course, your decision, Senator, but I just have to let you know that we don't know enough yet. I mean, look, we know that at the time that McCain chose Palin, the campaign had not made contact with any other politician in Alaska. They hadn't talked to Republicans or Democrats in the legislature. They hadn't talked to anybody who served on the town council while Palin was mayor of Wasilla. So they hadn't done most of the basic homework, and I'm sure McCain would have been told that.
Yeah, that's hard to believe. Was there any point during the last 8 years when President Bush looked questioningly at Dick Cheney and wondered whether or not he would keep him?
I have no reason to think that that's true. Angler describes a trajectory of the Cheney vice presidency in which he is enormously powerful in shaping policy from the beginning, and he has a very sort of productive period in which he actually has the steering wheel a lot of the time. Although I show that Bush says no to him more often than we realize. But by around the end of the first term, he was beginning to lose influence with Bush, and he's much less powerful now. So Bush did come to see that there were disadvantages to Cheney's advice, that there were things that Cheney wasn't telling him or that Cheney wasn't taking into account. I found no evidence that Bush ever gave consideration to dropping him from the ticket in 2004, and that's the only way that Cheney could have gone, because I don't know whether everyone knows this, but you can't fire a vice president. He's an independently elected constitutional officer, and it's not up to the president who's the number two once they're elected.
What was his, a lot of people talk about, and you've studied this pretty extensively in the book and written about it, who had the power right after 9/11? Was Cheney the person who was making strategy here, talking about shooting down airplanes? Who had control then?
The best analogy I can come up with is something that, it's a term that they use in the U.S. military. They use it as an acronym, which is UNODIR, which stands for Unless Otherwise Directed. So George Bush really was the decider. Whenever he didn't want Cheney to do something or did want Cheney to do something, that's what happened. But he was content to make policy from a very high level of generality. You know, I don't want to coddle terrorists. I want to take the gloves off and go after them. It was up to Cheney to be the implementer. And so Bush did not give him such specific directions at that time. So Dick Cheney would take initiatives in service of what he believed to be the shared goals with the president, but he would do things that the president had neither approved nor rejected, and in that way he carved out an enormous amount of independent power. Now, on the shootdown incident, a lot of people will remember that a big question for the 9/11 commission was who was responsible for the order made that morning that if there were any additional hijacked aircraft heading toward a civilian target, that the U.S. Air Force had permission to shoot it down, even though there would be knowledge that there were innocents aboard. Bush and Cheney both stated unequivocally that the president gave the order first and Cheney simply passed it along. The commission said it could find no evidence for that, but did not choose to conclude that it was false. And I've come up with new evidence and new ways of reading the existing evidence that make it pretty categorical that the official account is not true, that Cheney gave the order himself, and he asked for a blessing afterward, and that Bush then gave that blessing.
Hmm. And where was he?
Cheney was in the what's generally called the bunker under the White House. He had been sitting in his office watching live as the second aircraft hit the World Trade Center and was beginning to call cabinet officers, consult with his staff, and figure out what the crisis management would be because, as everyone recalls, George Bush was in Florida reading a story to elementary school students. Cheney was in the middle of this meeting when the Secret Service showed up and said, "Sir, we have to move you right now," because they'd had a report, it turned out to be a false report, that a plane was heading straight for the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Cheney sort of nods at them and keeps on talking. You know, he's doing his business. "All right, well, I'll get to you pretty soon." And the lead Secret Service agent leans over Cheney's desk, slaps his hand down on the table, and says, "Right now." And he picks him up by the belt, and another agent joins him, and the Vice President of the United States is basically frog-marched out of his office from the West Wing to the East Wing, and this is something that Secret Service, as you could imagine, must practice.
Right.
And they find a secret door that people don't usually know about, and they take him down, you know, some dozens of feet underground into this bunker, which is officially called the Presidential Emergency Operations Center. It turns out, by the way, that this thing was not so well equipped and wasn't working so well on 9/11, and they've upgraded it since.
Well, that's good. Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is the author of Angler, the Cheney Vice President. Barton Gellman is with us. He's the winner of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for a series of articles he did about Dick Cheney that appeared in the Washington Post. He's a special projects reporter at the Post and has also covered diplomacy, the Middle East, the Pentagon, and the D.C. Superior Court. He also won another Pulitzer in 2002 for national reporting. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 8655, and we have lines open for you right now if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also send an email. That's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. He has a lot to write about the crisis over the NSA surveillance that he says nearly made President Bush a one-term president. We'll talk extensively about that and more, so join the conversation if you have any questions about Dick Cheney. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, and our guest is the author of Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency, just published by Penguin Press. Let's look at it. You spent a lot of time on this, and it was a substantial issue, and that's the NSA surveillance. Do you really believe that this all could have made President Bush a one-term president?
Well, that's a pretty big claim, and I think that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and I spent two whole chapters on this in Angler. It is a hugely consequential story, not only for George Bush's White House, but I think for the presidency itself. You had a rebellion at the Justice Department in which the whole top of the department and the FBI came to believe that parts of the warrantless domestic surveillance program were illegal. And Dick Cheney spent 3 months trying to put down this uprising, to essentially force them to withdraw their objections. And during those 3 months, George Bush did not know about it. Cheney was in the most positive way you could characterize it would be he was trying to solve the president, solve the problem for the president rather than bring the president in. But it got to the point where anyone would say the president ought to know about this. And the president did not find out until the night before the program was going to expire. And that was the night that he sent the chief of staff, Andy Card, and the White House counsel, Al Gonzalez, to the hospital bedside of the ailing attorney general to try to get him at the last minute to sign off. Now, the reason I say that this would have ended the Bush presidency is that I have on the record comments from people like Dan Bartlett, who was one of the president's top political and communications advisors, and he said so. What came very close to happening, probably within an hour of happening, until Bush found out what was really going on, is that there was going to be a mass exodus from the Justice Department and the FBI. The director of the FBI, the general counsel of the FBI, the general counsel of the CIA, and the whole top five layers of the Justice Department, which is a couple of dozen people, were all prepared to resign over this. And Bush found out only at the last second in time to avert the resignation. So the comparison that's made is, think back to Nixon and the Saturday night massacre. This involves essentially the firing of three people, or two resign and one is fired, at the top of the Justice Department. Now we're talking about a couple of dozen people at the top of the Justice Department and elsewhere. You wouldn't call that a massacre. You just have to call that suicide.
Mm-hmm. And Gonzalez, in this hospital room with Ashcroft, is saying, which is not true, that Gonzalez and Cheney had received congressional approval for this?
He tried to give the impression to Ashcroft. Now, remember, John Ashcroft, the attorney general, was in intensive care recovering from gallstone surgery and sort of in and out of consciousness. And he tried to persuade Ashcroft that they had achieved, he used essentially mumbo-jumbo language. He said, "We've achieved a legislative remediation." By the way, we've known about the hospital visit for 2 years now, but I was able to tell the story sort of hour by hour, minute by minute, with lots of new information, because I finally persuaded James Comey, who was the acting attorney general, and Jack Goldsmith, and Andrew Card, and Condi Rice, and others to talk about this in public for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And this mumbo-jumbo legislative remediation, it didn't really mean anything. What happened was that Cheney had called a meeting for eight congressional leaders in which he essentially asked them a question that answered itself, which is, could you rewrite the law secretly? Could you rewrite the law without anybody noticing in order to protect this program? And they said, well, you know, we have hearings and laws are published, so not really. And Gonzalez was sent over to portray this as Congress saying, you go ahead and proceed with this program, even though the Justice Department says that it doesn't comply with the law. And that's, I've talked to four people who were in the room, and that's not what they said.
Mm-hmm. And who is it who says, I'm sure when we leave office, we're all going to be hauled up before congressional committees and grand juries? David Addington, was that David Addington?
That is David Addington. David Addington is the president's, he's right now the vice president's chief of staff. He was the vice president's counsel, his top lawyer, and he's been a kind of intellectual alter ego for Cheney for decades, since the 80s. And he looms very large in this book. He's a large figure. He's a huge man, in, you know, big, booming voice, piercing intellect, absolutely sort of contemptuous of people who disagree with him. But it's crucial to understand that both Addington and Cheney are serving their own principles. They're serving their genuine beliefs that they stand for what the Constitution really means. They're not trying to get around the Constitution. They're trying to apply to the federal government a quite radical view of what the Constitution means. But if you want to understand what happened these last 8 years, you have to understand that they mean it, that they're sincere about that. And so Addington says to another lawyer at one point, and when seen in the book, yeah, I'm sure that when we leave office, we're all going to be hauled before grand juries or congressional committees. And he's not expressing consciousness of guilt. He's saying all these idiots don't understand what the law really is, and they're going to come in and try to tell us we broke the law, but they're wrong.
Oh, my. And what did President Bush have to say about all this?
President Bush is a politician, and at heart, in many ways, he's a pragmatist. He does not like to revisit decisions, and he likes big, what he calls game-changing strategies. And so if he decides that he's going to bring democracy to the Middle East by the Iraq War, it's very hard to change his mind before or after. But he is fundamentally a pragmatist about being a politician, about the need to carry the country along with him. Cheney's an anti-politician, but the president can't be. And so when the president finds out at the last second, it's Friday morning at 9:30 a.m. on March 12th of 2004, he finds out almost by accident, and I sort of trace this sort of exactly how it is that he found out, he finds out almost by accident that there's about to be this mass resignation. Cheney's advice is, doesn't matter if somebody threatens to resign, maybe they will, maybe they won't, but you can't be held hostage if you're doing the right thing. You and I believe that it's the right thing to do this warrantless domestic surveillance. You know, it's sort of like you don't bow to a terrorist threat and you don't bow to threats from your own people. And Bush says, hold on now. If I let all these people resign in protest over a belief that my policy is unlawful,
right.
You know, hello, we've got an election in 7 months coming up. And frankly, I imagine, and here I'm switching from what I know to what I suspect, but I suspect he understood that there was a significant danger of impeachment. Yeah, if you had the whole top of the Justice Department and the FBI say he was behaving unlawfully.
Yeah, I would think that would be a fairly big story, right? And reaching, as somebody says, Watergate territory?
Yeah, well, the top political advisor to John Ashcroft, again, a loyal Republican, a loyal supporter of George Bush, he was the chief Republican spokesman in 2000 for the Republican National Committee to try to get George Bush elected. He said, you have this resignation, and you're getting into Watergate territory. Hmm. He said the media frenzy and the frenzy on Capitol Hill would have been unlike anything we'd ever seen.
Hmm.
Cheney was prepared to accept that in service of his principles, and George Bush said, "Wait a minute, dude, that's not how you act when you're in the Oval Office."
We're talking with Barton Gellman this hour. His book is Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. Our number is 800-486-8655 if you'd like to join our conversation, or the email address is talk@WPR.org. Casey from Green Bay, hi, you're on the air.
How are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Oh, wonderful. First off, I'd start off by telling you I'm an extreme diehard Republican. I voted for George Bush and Mr. Cheney twice, and I'm extremely disappointed in the results of the last 8 years. My main question is, what did his effect on doing things eliminate the possibility of Colin Powell staying in that cabinet? And really, in theory, Colin Powell should be the Republican candidate for president right now. And he virtually has left the party due to Mr. Cheney. And I'd like to have your response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Casey.
The relationship between Dick Cheney and Colin Powell is fascinating and complicated. And your listeners will remember, goes back a long way. Dick Cheney elevated Colin Powell to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff just before the Gulf War. And at the time he did that, Colin Powell was the most junior four-star general in the Army. It was unheard of to elevate him above all of his seniors, but Cheney saw something impressive in him and wanted him. Nevertheless, when Cheney was defense secretary and Colin Powell was chairman, their relationship was correct and professional, but not friendly. Cheney always suspected Powell of being a little too fond of his own press clippings, a little too eager to be popular, and Cheney has nothing but disdain for public opinion and thinks it's very important to do just what you think is the right thing, whether or not you get approval. And there were other issues between them. So by the time they're in the second Bush administration, Powell is Secretary of State, and he's fundamentally a moderate. He fundamentally believes in process. He fundamentally believes in trying to talk to your allies and persuade them and see whether you can find some common ground with your enemies. That war is a last resort, and Cheney just saw Powell as an obstacle, and he went around him. there was time after time when Cheney caused decisions to be made, created fait accompli, and Powell found out only afterward. Again, this is one of those stories that I tell in Angler where Cheney, and I can sort of show this like hand by hand as the document gets handed off, Cheney brings a proposal to the president in a private lunch, 4 pages typed out by Cheney's own lawyer that almost no one else has seen. And after whatever passes between them, Cheney hands it to one lawyer, hands it to another, to a third, to the deputy White House staff secretary, and next thing you know, an hour later, it is the executive order of the President of the United States that there will be military tribunals for terrorists, that they'll be stripped of all rights of access to any U.S. or foreign court. And Colin Powell is watching CNN when it's announced, and he picks up the phone, calls one of his top aides, and says, "What the heck just happened?" That wasn't the word he used.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. You know, it's interesting that you describe Cheney as thinking that Powell is a guy who's too eager to be popular. I don't have that impression of Colin Powell at all. He seems to be a bit off the mark in describing him. Would you describe him that way?
Well, here again, you're getting to the inside of someone's head. But let's put it this way.
Okay.
When Powell was selected to be Secretary of State in the first Bush administration, he was the third most popular man in America, and the first was the Pope, and the second was not George Bush. So, he has been enormously popular over the years. He certainly has been careful to cultivate his image, whether he would sacrifice the right thing in order to be popular, which is, I think, maybe what Cheney thought. That's probably going pretty far. Mm. I haven't seen any evidence of that.
Mm-hmm. So that wasn't a part of his appearance at the United Nations?
Well, there actually is an element of that here.
Really?
Colin Powell was asked to make the case for war with Iraq, partly because the public understood that Powell was reluctant to go to war in Iraq. So, in effect, if this guy says it's true, it must be true. And, in fact, Cheney sort of walked up to him in one meeting, and this is something that Bob Woodward has reported. It's not my reporting. And he sort of poked Powell in the chest and said, "You've got plenty of popularity to spare. You can afford a few points." And so Powell says, "All right, well, I'll make this case because the president wants me to." But it's Cheney and Cheney's office who try to write the script, and Powell is very concerned that he not put his own reputation on the line for anything that he can't stand behind it. So he spends, you know, a whole weekend at the CIA on the 7th floor at George Tenet's executive suite, going through line by line the script they want him to read and rejecting things that he can't support. It turns out he didn't reject enough because a whole lot of the things he said turned out to be false. And in fact, several of them were contradicted by U.S. intelligence itself. But he was trying to do his due diligence here. And one of the explicit reasons was he didn't want to put his own reputation on the line for something untrue.
Right. Let's go to Shelley from Madison, our next caller. Our number is 800-486-8655. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, I just have a quick question, and then I'll take my answer off the air. But I find it interesting that you're talking about that he's that he doesn't really like to listen to polls and doesn't really kind of sounds like he doesn't really want to know what the American public thinks. And so I'm curious what his views are on the idea that government should a democratic government should serve the people and be for the people and by the people. And because it sounds like he thinks the people are a little too stupid to maybe be having opinions about certain things, and that in that case, then government should just take over and kind of ignore what people want or what people think. And that's my question.
Okay, thanks, Shelley.
That's a fascinating question. If Dick Cheney had agreed to talk to me for this book, it's an area I would have most wanted to explore. He has, you can piece together from some of the things he has said in public and private over the years, that he does believe in democracy, again, as he sees it. And in so many places, Dick Cheney starts with a fairly unexceptionable proposition, even an admirable one, for example, that you don't really want a politician with his finger to the wind saying what everybody wants to hear and changing from one day to the next as the polls go up and down. That's not leadership, and most people, when they're polled, say they don't want someone who follows the polls that closely. Cheney takes that to the extreme of saying you don't have to pay attention to the polls at all. So in the famous Lincoln phrase that the caller suggested of by and for the people, he certainly believes in government for the people. He thinks he's serving the public interest, but sort of and by, he has a very narrow view of it. And I actually trace the roots of his thinking to Edmund Burke, who was an 18th century philosopher and public figure in England, who was very skeptical of the mob and the ability of the crowd, the sort of the great unwashed, to understand the difficult questions. And he believed in the importance of an elite that would govern on their behalf. Cheney understands that he has to be elected. But once elected, he says, choose wisely. It's sort of like picking a surgeon. Do your homework, pick someone who's good, and then don't try to tell him where to make the cut.
He wouldn't speak with you for the book. And let's talk about where we have seen Dick Cheney over the past 8 years. We've seen him occasionally on Meet the Press, but as you write, most of his interviews have been to politically friendly radio and television hosts, opinion columnists, and magazines. He's been on Rush Limbaugh. He's been on Fox News quite a bit. Why would he do that? Why would he just exclude a portion, and a significantly large part of the population that maybe doesn't go that route, doesn't listen to those shows, that goes another way?
Well, since he is so little interested in his own image, and one of the defining features of his vice presidency all along has been that he never intended to run for president himself, and so he didn't have to go out and cultivate his own following. He speaks only for instrumental reasons. If there's a moment when he thinks he can help move the needle in a way that would help carry out, sort of help pass a piece of legislation or get a congressional candidate in a closely contested district into office and help decide a majority or sell a particularly difficult nominee to the Republican base, that's when he goes out and speaks in public. So he's going out to rally the troops, and it's often rallying the sort of conservative Republican troops because he needs their energy to make something happen. So, for example, he does that with controversial nominees. He did it even for Harriet Myers, who, you know, I tell the story in Angler that he thought the Harriet Myers nomination for the Supreme Court, and you'll remember that she was George Bush's first White House staff secretary and later became White House counsel, someone Bush knew well. He wanted to nominate a woman. Most people said that she was grossly unqualified to be on the Supreme Court, and the nomination was withdrawn. Cheney strongly opposed it internally, but he went out loyally and defended it on Rush Limbaugh because conservatives were among those who rebelled, and he was trying to help the president. So he goes out and talks when it will serve a specific practical purpose, and that often is talking to the already convinced.
Let's go to Rick from Madison next. Hi, Rick.
Hi. It's really interesting hearing your discussion. I've always thought of Dick Cheney a little bit like Darth Vader. He seems to have a demeanor that's totally emotionless, and when I've heard him on the debates and any other time, he seems to be devoid of emotion and purely argument on the logical side. But it's kind of shivering to hear him, the pitch of his voice and how he's doesn't seem to get, nothing seems to affect him in a emotional way. And I don't know if anybody else has found that, but I mean, I think it's kind of speaks a lot about the kind of person he is.
It's funny because over the years, that very same flat, laconic, precise demeanor has been seen as a big positive for him. Even people who've disagreed with him on substance over the years, back when he was in the House as number two leader and as defense secretary, as White House chief of staff for Gerald Ford before that, he's always talked exactly the same way. And before he was associated with sort of radically conservative positions, people kind of liked that, or more people liked that. When he's using that affect to describe the unpleasant things we're going to have to do and the need to have what he calls robust interrogations of terrorists or any number of other controversial policies, then it starts to be kind of chilling, and Rick's not the only one who says so. Cheney himself invoked the imagery of Darth Vader indirectly very early after 9/11 when he spoke of the dark side on Meet the Press a week or two after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And he was not unaware of what dark side means in pop culture. I mean, there have been two decades of Star Wars. It was an image that was used all the time in the 2000 campaign as in the ones that came before it. And so he's invoking this image to say, we're going to have to cross into that kind of territory to fight the bad guys. And so since then, he's basically embraced the Darth Vader image to the point that last year for Halloween, he dressed his dog as the Lord of the Sith.
Did he really? And what kind of dog does he have?
It's a black lab, so it goes well with costume.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking this hour with the author of Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. Barton Gellman is with us. Our phone number, thank you very much, Rick, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We will spend some time talking about the Iraq War in a moment with our guest. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Oh, the email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now with the author of Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency, Barton Gellman, is our guest, and we start calls again now with Rob from Madison. Hi, Rob. Hi, Rob. Are you there? All right. We'll put you on hold, Rob, and hope that you come back. I know that Rob wanted to talk, and I want to move into this territory as well, about the war in Iraq. How instrumental was Cheney in formulating U.S. policy after September 11 in identifying Iraq and in taking this country to war?
Dick Cheney was enormously influential in taking the country to war, but no, he was not the only one, and his reasons were different than other people's reasons. I've finally been able to persuade some of Cheney's own top foreign policy advisors in his office to speak on the record in Angler about why Iraq. And Cheney was looking for, it was a very traditional sort of balance of power, realist school of U.S. interests. He wanted what they called a demonstration effect. He wanted to show enemies of the United States in the wake of 9/11, especially state enemies, hostile countries, you don't want to mess with us. So he was looking for someone to make an example of. That's the demonstration effect. And so in that sense, you fight a war with Iraq because you can. Because it's a lot tougher nut to crack if you're going after Iran or North Korea militarily. And in fact, Cheney worried more about Iran and North Korea when it came to the possibility of someone developing weapons of mass destruction and handing them off to terrorists or letting them escape. Iraq was sort of no more than third on his list, but it was the easiest one to do. And, you know, there was some unfinished business from the first Gulf War. The president and lots of other people, there was the whole, Cheney's often called a neoconservative. He's not. He has neoconservatives working for him. But people like Paul Wolfowitz and Scooter Libby, who was then Cheney's chief of staff, and other folks around the government, were interested in spreading democracy. They were interested in setting a different kind of example. They were interested in sort of bringing down a tyrant, standing up a democracy, as they would say, and beginning a kind of a domino effect in that sense in the Middle East, in which other sort of oppressed populations would want to rise up and have democratic states themselves. Cheney was quite skeptical of whether that was really going to happen, but that was the idea that brought Bush to the war. And so you have actually the president and vice president sort of meeting figuratively at the gates of Baghdad, but they've taken two completely different paths to get there.
It's interesting. You quote this historian who said that Cheney was very depressed about both the options of going to war and not going to war.
Yeah, the thing about Cheney that's unlike Bush is that he is a sponge for information. He collects an enormous amount of information and intelligence. He wants to know what's really happening. He wants to know what people really think. And he doesn't talk only to people who agree with him. He's perfectly happy to have people say you're wrong, and especially if they could give him good, detailed reasons in which he learned something. And he actually thought the Iraq War was kind of a close call. He thought it was important in the end, and he would never say this publicly. But he did say, I mean, on the very evening that the White House won the Iraq War authorization from Congress, Cheney had this dinner party for Victor Davis Hanson, a well-known conservative historian, mainly of the classics, Trojan War, that sort of thing. And he asked him to talk about the role of political leaders in unpopular wars, because I think he foresaw that this would be an unpopular war that would not go like clockwork. And he was really on the fence. I mean, he was willing to argue both sides of, is this a good idea? And Victor Davis Hanson reports that Cheney was, as you say, depressed and very, very kind of, he did not have this celebratory, we're going to go get him kind of attitude that a lot of others in the Bush administration had.
Jackie from Madison next. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I have a question regarding how Dick Cheney was chosen to be vice president and what role did he have in his own selection? Wasn't he part of the group that...
Yeah, you probably came in late. We spent a lot of time on that at the beginning. Can you just give us a couple-sentence answers so we don't repeat ourselves? Barton?
George Bush asked Cheney to run the selection process and screen the candidates and advise him. He also asked Cheney early on to be the vice presidential running mate. Cheney said no, played hard to get, screened the other candidates. And by the time he was chosen, he did not make any of the disclosures that the others were forced to make.
Thanks, Jackie, for your call. Eric from Milwaukee. Hi.
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 I have a question about if there is a physiological cause for the asymmetry in the appearance of Dick Cheney's face.
That's a great question.
Yes, I've wondered that, too.
I don't know. He famously has that sort of half smile or quarter smile, if you count it as a half on half of his face. And I don't know the answer to that. He has never released his full medical records. That is sometimes...
Oops, hello? Hello? I think we lost our guest there for a moment, and I hope John can hear me. We lost our guest for the last couple minutes. Our number, if you would like to join the conversation, is 800. We lost our guest, so we'll get him back. We have only a couple minutes left, but he was in the middle of a story. Our number is 800-486-8655. And so we'll have him finish that story, we hope, and we can reach him again and then take maybe one or two phone calls for him. Just a reminder to you that we're at Marquette University. It's a chance for me to talk about this. A week from today, our program running from 9 to 11, you're invited to be a part of the audience as we talk politics with people from the presidential campaigns, with journalists who have been covering these campaigns for a long time now, with political analysts. It should be just a really good time. And students, of course, from Marquette, too, who have been involved in the Obama campaigns, the McCain campaigns, the Libertarian campaigns. So join us. Oh, yeah, let me give you the number for that. And that number is 414-227-2047 to say that you'd like to be a part of the audience. We left you right in the middle of, and I had to switch tracks here. We left you in the middle of a sentence, Barton, and you were talking about why the side of his face is different. One side is different than the other, and you'd love to know that, and then we lost you. So,
yes, sorry about that communication glitch here. I don't know. I thought Eric was going to ask about Cheney's heart condition and whether that accounts for personality change or what seems to be a personality change over the years. And there is interesting speculation, but again, we don't have the records. He's had 9 cardiac events in the last 8 years, and he's had a lifetime history of 4 heart attacks and many other heart problems. It is commonly but not always observed in patients who have this sort of cumulative heart damage that the disease of the arteries from the heart is sometimes accompanied by disease of the arteries that feed the brain, and there are well-known effects, again, not universally, and we don't know if they affect Cheney, that include sort of more emotional brittleness and loss of judgment and rationality. But I must say that there's been very little sign that Cheney has been forced to cut back his workload. This even keel that you see in public is reflected also in private. He just doesn't blow up. So I'm a little skeptical that this accounts for much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us and for the book. It was a great hour. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And if people want to learn more, you can find it on BartonGelman.com.
Okay, great. BartonGelman.com, and you spell his last name G-E-L-L-M-A-N. The book is Angler, The Cheney Vice Presidency. And Barton is winner of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for his series of articles on Dick Cheney in the Washington Post. He also won the prize in 2002. This book is published by Penguin. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.